Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
No, that's not the Brian Lehrer Show theme. It is, of course, Imagine by John Lennon and Yoko Ono from 1971. And folks, that begins our Thanksgiving gift to you this morning. Our team is off for the holiday, but we think we've got a great show for you to cook by or travel to grandma's house by or whatever you're doing this morning. This year on the show, as some of you know, we've been celebrating the 50th anniversary of so much iconic music. 1971 was, by many accounts, one of the most important years for a number of musical genres, albums ranging from Carole King's Tapestry to Alice Coltrane's Journey in Such a Ananda to Black Sabbath's Master of Reality. So today, as you prepare for your gatherings, be they in person, virtual, or some combination thereof, we've put together a show of some of these conversations. And let's start here with Imagine, one of the most iconic of any albums, and the title track in particular by John Lennon and Yoko Ono. One piece of fairly recent news about Imagine, it's 4 years old, but that makes it fairly recent in the 50-year history of the song, that you may not know is that Yoko Ono was officially added as a co-author, a co-writer of the song. So we are delighted to be joined by Sean Ono Lennon, musician, member of the bands The Ghost, also known as The Ghost of a Saber-Toothed Tiger, and the Claypool Lennon Delirium, also founder of Chimera Music, a collaborative artist-run label and arts collective based here in New York City, and of course, son of John and Yoko. Sean, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate you coming on WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. It's good to be here. I'm excited to be on the show. I'm a big fan.
And I'm delighted to hear that. And let me start with what I was just telling the audience about. A lot of people still don't know that in 2017, your mom officially got added to the songwriting credits for Imagine. How did that come about?
Well, it was documented that my dad had said my mom co-wrote Imagine with him. And he sort of admitted that he was too insecure, basically, to share credit at the time because it was only his second solo wreck, and you know, he had just kind of been wrapping up with the Beatles, so he sort of said it that he didn't give her credit because he was too insecure. So it was documented that that was a fact, and I think it just was, you know, recognized later, which is nice because, you know, my mom is to wait a long time, I guess, to get her due in that regard.
And the song was released in 71, but I read that the word Imagine really got into your parents' writing lives from a book and conceptual art project that Yoko had released in 1964. Is that something you're familiar with?
Yeah, of course. I mean, well, if you look at my mom's conceptual art instructions, which most famously can be seen in the book Fruit, which is the sort of compendium of a lot of her conceptual ideas, you know, as a conceptual artist, she always believed that art is conceptual, and so you would describe a painting in a written word, or you just sculpture, and it was kind of a borderline between performance art and poetry, but it was a lot of imagination exercise, and the idea of imagine this, imagine that, as a theme, came from my mother's work and her conceptual art.
Were there other songs that your mother contributed to but didn't get credit for?
Look, I mean, I'm not going to get into that because it's not for me to say. It would be for my mother, or it would have been for my dad to say. But, you know, it's a perfect thing how people decide their own songwriting credit. So, I you know, I wouldn't know. But, you know, they lived together. They were joined at the hip, and they certainly influenced each other a lot. And, you know, for example, my mom produced the Imagine album, which I think a lot of people overlook because Phil Spector was there. And, you know, I think, you know, being a woman, it's easy to sort of assume that it was just a general credit on my dad's part to give her that production credit. But the truth is, if you look at the footage of them recording, she's making decisions. He's asking for her advice after every take. So she really did produce, you know, one of the most successful albums of all time, and I don't think people recognize her as a great record producer, but she technically is. It's sort of undeniable in that case.
I'm glad we got that out. In 1971, the Vietnam War was raging. Modern environmentalism and feminism were breaking out. The Beatles had recently broken up. You weren't born until 4 years later, but what's your best understanding of whether the song was inspired by something in particular or sort of the multiple hugenesses of the moment?
I mean, that's a big question. You could probably get a master's writing about that subject because there was a confluence of a lot of things happening, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s. But it's just the Vietnam. I mean, there was a cultural revolution happening, you know, in the West and also elsewhere. So, you know, there's a lot of historical things that were a confluence of events that were, I'm sure, in my dad's head and everyone's radar. But, you know, I think for my dad, it had to do with, I mean, I don't like speaking for him, but this is totally my personal subjective view, mm-hmm. is that I think for him leaving Beatles and starting to work with my mom, He spoke about how his lyrical style became less, you know, less flowery and less surreal and became more confessional and more simplistic. He was very influenced by my mom, but also by haikus. He spent a lot of time in Japan, and he said that haiku was his favorite form of poetry. And you can see on his album, Plastic Ono Band, the lyrics were very simple and super autobiographical. It was almost just very stark. And I think that was a revelation for him because he was known more for, you know, I am the walrus and I am he is you for me and those kinds of wordplay songs. So I think for him, Imagine is almost like a children's, you know, a lullaby. It was in its simplicity, and it was a kind of incantation prayer. I think it's a breakaway from his more verbose style of lyricism in the Beatles.
Yeah, interesting. Out of the whole body of your father's work, where would you say Imagine ranks among the songs that other people most want to talk about to you?
To me personally? Well, it's always going to take and shelf to Beautiful Boy because people just like to bring that one up when they meet me.
Because it's about you.
Probably, yeah. I think like a lot of my dad's work, certain pieces sort of transcend, you know, the box of just being a song. I feel like certain great works of art transcend the artist and the individual, and they become sort of something that's shared by the collective, you know, culture, the collective unconscious or whatever. So it's part of the ether and the fabric of, you know, modern culture to me. And I think the song is almost bigger than him in a way. And that's not to diminish him as a person. I think at a certain point, great works of art sort of transcend, you know, time and space, and they become intertwined in the fabric of things.
Sean Ono Lennon with us for another few minutes. What are you doing musically these days? And I'm curious how the pandemic has affected you as a musician, because I know it's been so isolating for so many musicians who couldn't perform and at the beginning couldn't even connect with their band members in person.
Yeah, well, I think musicians were hit in a similar way to a lot of industries that you know, normally require people to be in the same room at the same time, whether it's playing a live show or being in the studio, traveling, you know, for touring, it all ended. We did cancel a couple of tours when it began, my band, The Delirium. But yeah, now I'm about to start a new record for The Delirium. And I wound up doing a lot of work from home. Like a lot of people, we adapted to like a home version of what we used to do. And I've been producing albums. I've been producing stuff for different artists. But instead of them coming to my studio like usual, I've been doing it through Zoom and kind of remotely. But it's, you know, it's a different way of working. It's, you know, there's the upside that, you know, you don't always have to wear pants, you know, to the office. But the downside is you don't get that interpersonal or physical connection. But, you know, I think, you know, musicians are not alone in that. I think it's happened to a lot of people. So, you know, we managed to adapt, and luckily we're starting to tour again, and hopefully we'll manage to do that throughout next year without having some kind of fourth wave or whatever you call it. We're all hoping for that.
Be careful about that not wearing pants on Zoom thing. You know, you get up to go to the kitchen, you're not thinking about it. And then...
I was thinking about that poor man who was caught. But yeah, I like working at home. You know, in a way I feel spoiled because I have my, you know, studio computer here and I can just make music anyway. But I do miss the interaction. So, you know, hopefully we'll get back to normal or something like it very soon.
Looking forward to it, of course. And last question, Sean, Imagine ends with the line, "You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one." So they're trying to coax people in some way, explicitly with that lyric. At least that's what it seems like. Do you think the song actually, as it has transcended in the way that you were describing before, has actually changed anything, or do you think music ever can?
Wow. I mean, you know, these are heavy questions, man. I think that as much as a song can change things in the abstract, Imagine probably has had as much influence as a song can have, really. But I do think that, you know, music and art can only go so far. And the infrastructure of, you know, of society, the government and the banks and all of that, you know, there's a lot of brick and mortar and steel and glass that's in place. So I don't know if a song can transform everything, but I think it can be, you know, a beacon of light that guides us in a good direction and makes us feel more connected. I think for me, it's more about sharing common culture with our fellow humans. And, you know, if we all feel that we love the song Imagine, then we're sort of sharing an ideology that brings us brings us closer together. And I do think that that is an accomplishment. And I think Imagine probably has done that as much as any piece of art ever could hope to do.
Yeah, nicely said. Sean Ono Lennon, these days making music with the Claypool Lennon Delirium. So nice of you to come on to acknowledge the 50th anniversary of Imagine with us. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and that is Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satchidananda. We're looking at, or rather listening to, some iconic albums that turned 50 this year and digging into the political and social context in which they were made and their impact on both music and culture. The music historians say 1971 was a particularly important year. Joining me now to talk about Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satchidananda and how it was shaped by its time, and also why it's gaining popularity now more than ever, is Andy Beta, music writer whose byline has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, The Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, NPR, and more. Thanks for doing this, Andy. Welcome to WNYC.
Happy to be here, Brian.
And let's start really basic. Some listeners might be asking themselves, Alice Coltrane, any relation to John Coltrane, the legendary jazz composer and saxophonist? So let's begin with a little background on, yes, John Coltrane's spouse. Can you give us a brief introduction to her life up until she met her husband, John Coltrane?
Yes. Alice Coltrane was born Alice McLeod in Detroit in 1937. And she started her career playing the piano and organ in a local Baptist church. And it's probably a little bit lost to time, but, you know, after the war, Detroit was the industrial center of the country, and it was also a bebop hotspot. So you had Donald Byrd, Yusef Lateef, Elvin Jones, Cecil McBee, and a lot of other jazz players all came out of Detroit's hometown scene. And Alice's own family was a musical family. Her mother played in the church choir. Her sister Marilyn went on to become a songwriter at Motown. And her half-brother, Ernest Farrow, was a prominent jazz bassist in the city. And so she, you know, took up piano and organ at an early age and started playing in these churches and in the city and experienced what she called the gospel experience of her life. It was a very formative early experiences for her. And as she grew up, her half-brother encouraged her to kind of keep at it. So she kept playing jazz, played bebop, married a scat singer, and moved to Paris, where she was mentored by another bebop legend, Bud Powell, before her marriage ended and she wound up back in Detroit, which is where she joined a vibraphonist there by the name of Terry Gibbs, and they began playing in Detroit. And they landed this gig opening for the John Coltrane Quartet in 1963. And, you know, soon after that, John and Alice were together.
Did John and Alice Coltrane record together before his death in 1967?
Many times. There was, you know, at this point in time, the John Coltrane Quartet was one of the most beloved jazz bands working at that time. But by 1965, the pianist McCoy Tyner and drummer Elvin Jones left the group. And soon after, Alice took over the role as pianist in the band.
Despite the ethereal sounds of harp and saxophone that we heard in the intro to this segment, and we'll play a few more track excerpts from Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satchidananda as we go, despite those ethereal sounds of harp and saxophone from that title track and in the whole album, it was born out of grief, we should say. John died of liver cancer in 1967, and according to an article in Pitchfork, the story goes that John Coltrane had ordered that harp but died before it could arrive. Could you elaborate on that story a little bit for us and the role of the harp on this album? Not an instrument you hear in jazz a lot.
Right. It's very much, you know, an album without a lot of history in the form. And I guess it should be known that, you know, in the 1960s, John Coltrane was, like many people in America, he was a seeker. He was reading the Bhagavad Gita, studying meditation, yoga. You know, it was very much of that time. And his sound began to change dramatically as he was pushing towards something, you know, that wasn't jazz, that wasn't necessarily blues, that could somehow embrace Indian classical, North African music. It was, you know, he called it a universal sound. And, you know, he himself didn't live to sort of realize this, and that sort of became Alice's mission. And in the Coltrane house itself, you know, he had a drum kit. He was studying, like, with wooden flutes, and he was always sort of trying out new instruments. I mean, most famously, you know, he picked up the soprano saxophone and, you know, learned that, and that became the instrument he used on, you know, his biggest work, My Favorite Things. And I think it's something along those lines that led him to sort of order this harp for his wife. And, you know, as you said, harp is a rare sound in jazz without much precedent. So I sort of imagine this gift for his wife as pushing towards new sounds and new possibilities. And we mentioned that, you know, John passes from liver cancer, and it was incredibly abrupt. He sort of complained about being in pain in May of that year, and 6 weeks later was gone. And, you know, she was left a widow by the age of 30 with her daughter from a previous marriage and three young sons that she had with John Coltrane. And then, you know, reeling with all this, this harp shows up, and she told Ebony magazine at the time, "I know it is his invisible hand that brought me through." So no doubt this harp arrives and it's sort of this sign from beyond, for lack of a better description.
That's a haunting story. I see that a few Alice Coltrane and Satchidananda fans are calling in as we continue our series on important albums in music that came out 50 years ago this year, 1971, considered an unusually important year in music and their social context. Today, it's Alice Coltrane's Journey in Satchidananda, with Andy Bader, music writer, whose byline has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, NPR, and more. But before we take a few calls and hear some more music excerpts, if there's a reason why people might not be so familiar with Alice Coltrane as compared to John, even though her popularity is rising these days, so long after her own death, you wrote in a recent article in the Washington Post that in jazz circles, Alice Coltrane was maligned and disparaged in a manner that I guess we could say anticipated the sort of vitriol that would be dumped on other spouses of beloved male rock stars like Yoko Ono and Courtney Love. So can you talk about why critics were so harsh toward her solo work at first?
You know, at the time, the Coltrane Quartet, as I said earlier, was one of the most beloved jazz groups of the time. They were just, you know, formidable. Nothing could stop them, you know, and they made so many classic albums. And then you see, you know, this sort of break up, you know, but McCoy Tyner leaves, Elvin Jones leaves, and for one reason or the other, this blame is sort of put onto Alice, right? Like, she's the reason they broke up, and, you know, it very much parallels this idea of, oh, it's Yoko Ono that breaks the Beatles up. The Beatles couldn't break up on their own. It had to be this outside force, this woman that comes in, and she's the one that makes, you know, this breakup possible. And I just think, you know, there was just these other elements where, you know, obviously Coltrane himself was undergoing these changes, and so instead of imparting it onto him, where, you know, John Coltrane himself is almost a sainted figure in jazz and in 20th century music. And so if he can do no wrong, then who is the blame for this? And, you know, unfortunately it becomes Alice because, you know, with his passing, Alice has control over the tapes and all the recordings he made in the years leading up to his death. And so, you know, as some of this music starts to come out posthumously, there's these other elements that she adds to these tapes. The most, you know, noteworthy is this album called Infinity, where she adds in another bass player, Charlie Hayden, who played with Ornette Coleman, and she adds strings and these other things, and which is basically heresy in jazz, right? Like, you know, overdubbing's frowned upon, adding these things after the performance is greatly frowned upon. And so, you know, she just dealt with, you know, criticism for her own work and then for how dare she add these elements to John Coltrane's music. And in 2002, she sort of addressed these criticisms in an interview with The Wire magazine where she was saying, you know, here's all these people saying, we know that the original recording didn't have any strings, so why didn't you leave it as it was? And, you know, her response was, well, were you there? Did you hear John's commentary and what he had to say? And, you know, goes on to say, we had a conversation about every detail. John was showing me how here these other sounds, blends, tonalities, and resonances, you know, these things could all sort of be in there. And as she argues, she was actually carrying out his vision by bringing these other elements in and, you know, taking his music to places that, were he to live, he probably would have done himself, but, you know, this became her role carrying the torch of his vision forward and, the slings and arrows that she faced because of this.
Interesting and important historical context there. So who gets to play the role of saxophonist after the death of her husband, John Coltrane, on Alice Coltrane's classic Journey in Satya Dinanda? It's Pharoah Sanders. So let's listen to just a little bit of his playing on the song from the album Stopover Bombay. Janine in Northern Virginia, you're on WNYC. Hi, Janine. Thank you for calling in.
Hey, Brian. I just wanted to say thank you so much for featuring this Alice Coltrane. She is amazing. And throughout COVID, one of the many things I do is I'm a conscious dance facilitator. My form that I share is Rhythm Therapy. And I was prepping for an online class because I've taken my classes online early on in the pandemic, and I found this through Spotify, and it just helped me through this whole year, finding a black hippie, an old school black hippie from, and I was born in 1970, so I was one when this came out. And it's like finding her was like finding a friend that I never knew existed, because I've been, you know, now there's been an upsurgence of black folks doing yoga and kinetic yoga and connecting to the African roots of yoga and spirituality in that way. And this music just blends the American form of jazz with ancient forms, with the harp and with African rhythms in such a way that during all of the chaos of COVID and last year with all of the social justice stuff with George Floyd, just to be able to lean into this music was a way that my mind and a lot of my students' minds were able to rest. So thank you for featuring this, and thank you to the expert for giving more perspective about Coltrane, about the couple, about their kids, and I just want to thank you so much. I lost my mom on the 11th, and literally I was listening to this as part of my healing. And it's just, you know, music really does make a difference. And so thank you for featuring this, and I hope that more folks will listen.
Thank you, Janine. Thank you so much. Wow. So, Andy, first, black hippie, do you second that description of Alice Coltrane from back in the day? And what about her rising popularity now? I mean, more family context, her son Ravi Coltrane is a well-known jazz saxophone player these days, the producer and rapper Flying Lotus is her grandnephew, worked with artists like Kamasi Washington, Thundercat, even Kendrick Lamar. So there's a kind of, I think, hip-hop influenced spiritual jazz music that's the context for which Alice Coltrane is making a posthumous comeback. So what can you say about any of that?
Well, I just sort of speak to Janine's point, and you know, whether I would call her a black hippie, you know, what she and John were doing definitely predates the sort of rise in hippiedom, and one could argue that John Coltrane's example sort of inspired these other musicians and rock to sort of take on this expanded, you know, consciousness and to learn more beyond like Western civilization and Western history. And, you know, the era we're talking about is very much about upheaval and, you know, the social ills of the time. And along with John Coltrane, you know, jazz became more fiery, more chaotic, more angry. And you also had artists like Abby Lincoln and Nina Simone who were growing more and more sort of politically outspoken. And also someone like Marvin Gaye, who's, you know, What's Going On, also comes from the same time. And, you know, really tackling these ills and, you know, these issues that are still present with us. And, you know, police violence, war, poverty, inequality, drug abuse, death. And obviously, as we've seen in the last year or two, like, these ills are still with us and very much still a problem in our society. And, you know, for many people who went through the last year and a half, is like, well, what do you do about it? And what's crucial for Alice is she turned inward. You know, you can call it, you know, in today's parlance, like, oh, it's self-care, it's spiritual self-preservation. And, you know, amid all of this, Alice was seeking sort of a higher wisdom. And, you know, everything around her is angry and, you know, engaged. And here she is in this way that would just be really baffling at the time. You know, it's like introspective, it's contemplative, it's gentle and impressionistic. And, you know, I think a lot about sort of Christ's message in Luke 17:21, where it says, behold, the kingdom of God is within you. And the journey in Satchidananda is that exactly, because when you think about taking a journey, you think about you're going somewhere, you're traveling, you're visiting something, and, you know, just in the name itself, it's a journey in Satchidananda. It's this inward journey that she's taking.
It's in the music. It's not to. That by itself is so interesting. So she had her journey in Satchidananda, George Harrison at that time, in the middle of all the things that were swirling around him as a member of the Beatles, turned, you know, to similar kinds of spirituality. Let me get Kathleen in Jersey City. And Kathleen, I apologize for having to crunch you, but 30 seconds, I know you're calling in about Satchidananda.
Oh, yeah. I was trained at Integral Yoga on 13th Street in New York City. And I was told there was a time when Integral Yoga was petering. There was a need to raise money to purchase a building in order to continue the work Satchidananda was doing. And it just so happened that he decided he was going to purchase the building, and he needed so much money. And it just happened that Alice Coltrane called up and said, I want to donate this amount of money. And it was the exact sum that he needed in order to purchase the building.
The last track we're going to listen to a little bit is the live recorded Isis and Osiris going out on this segment. But on it, listeners, you can hear Vishnu Wood playing the oud in the minor scale. And it's one of the songs on the album that sounds the saddest. We've talked so much about grief in the context of Alice Coltrane's journey in Satchidananda. And we thank Andy Beta, music writer, whose byline has appeared in the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, NPR, and more. Wrote about the Alice Coltrane album in the Washington Post. Thanks so much for coming on, Andy. This was really interesting and moving.
Thank you so much. I was honored to be here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and that is Carole King singing the title track to her 1971 album, Tapestry. We're looking at, or rather listening to, some iconic albums that turn 50 this year and digging into the political and social context in which they were made and their impact on both music and culture. The music historians say 1971 was a particularly important year. And joining me now to talk about Tapestry, and we'll hear some more track excerpts, is Lauren Glass, chair and professor of English at the University of Iowa and author of several books, including most recently Carole King's Tapestry for Bloomsbury's 33 and a Third series. Professor Glass, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian. It's an honor to be here.
And before we get further into this album, Tapestry, let's get a little bit into who Carole King was before Tapestry. She wrote really famous songs for other singers, right?
Indeed. Her and her husband, Jerry Goffin, worked for Al Nevins and Don Kirshner's Al Don Music, which was on Broadway, right down the street from the Brill Building. And they wrote a series of teen rock and roll hits, including Don't Bring Me Down, Take Care of My Baby, Chains, One Fine Day, The Locomotion, I'm Into Something Good, Up on the Roof. I mean, they created part of the, you know, the teen rock and roll sound of the early 60s.
And for people who know that list of songs that you just gave and know the hits of that day, that's so many of the giant songs sung by different kinds of artists. One big
absolutely.
Hit.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Many folks did those songs.
So one big hit from their time together was Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow, which was made famous in 1960 by the girl group The Shirelles. King recorded it for Tapestry. Another big hit that King recorded finally herself for the album was You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman, and let's listen to a bit of that, originally recorded by Aretha Franklin. I'm just going to leave now and listen to the rest of the song. No. So, first of all, that's a mind-boggler for some people. Wait, Carole King wrote songs for Aretha Franklin, including that? So what's the story behind that song?
Well, it's actually an industry legend, the story behind that one. King and Goffin were apparently walking down Broadway, and this was late in the Brill Building era, so, you know, there wasn't as many jobs or songs to write. A huge limousine pulled up with Jerry Wexler in it. He rolled down the window, stuck his head out, and said that he needed a big hit for Aretha, because, you know, Atlantic had just acquired her from Columbia, and Wexler actually proposed the title. He said that they should call it A Natural Woman. They went home that night and wrote it and delivered it to Wexler the next day. Wexler loved it. Aretha loved it. And it really became one of the biggest hits of what would be Aretha's rocket to popularity. She'd been in the music industry for 4 or 5 years already, but this was the beginning of her string of hit albums and singles that really made her the queen of soul.
Is there a larger story to tell there about the relationship between mostly white, mostly Jewish songwriters and black singers like Carole King and Aretha Franklin?
Indeed. You know, Carole King, a Brooklyn Jew, entered into a tradition that goes back at least to Lieber and Stoller, Al Jolson, Chess Records, of Jewish producers and songwriters producing the music and facilitating the production of music by mostly African-American performers. And it was a relationship that had its exploitative elements. The African-American performers didn't have rights then to the songs. But it was also, on another level, a richly collaborative culture that in some ways was ended by the rise of the singer-songwriter era, when you no longer had those kinds of collaborations, you know, sort of split, labor split between composition and performance. But it's very interesting to look back at the way that Carole King would sing demos of her songs, partly imitating R&B sounds. That was actually a trend in the industry at that time, so that the as a Jewish singer, she was imitating African-American singers who would then get her songs and sometimes imitate her demos. So there was a complex sort of dialectic of composition and mimicry between Jewish Americans and African Americans in the music industry at this time.
And what made that begin to change?
Well, partly it was the rise of the singer-songwriter, right? So once Bob Dylan and the Beatles came onto the scene, it became less respectable and less profitable to split the job in that way, and true artists were seen as writing their own work. And this affected both sides of the, shall we say, the racial divide, right? So we have the trend into R&B with Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, and those folks writing their own songs, and then a trend more into easy listening or folk rock or rock, where you have mostly white musicians also writing their own songs. So there was ironically, post-civil rights, in some ways, the music industry became more racially divided and encoded than it had been before. Although anyone will tell you that the music industry, you know, in terms of the charts and the culture, has always had racial divides and divisions defining how it operates.
Absolutely. We are talking about Carole King's Tapestry album at 50 with Lauren Glass, Chair and Professor of English at the University of Iowa and author of the book, Carole King's Tapestry. You write, the passage from the wistful and anxious, "Will you still love me tomorrow?" to the soaring affirmation of "You make me feel like a natural woman" on side two of Tapestry encapsulates the passage from girl to woman, both for King personally and for the generation of women to and for whom she wrote and sang. Do you want to elaborate a bit more on that?
Sure. It's part of my major thesis. I mean, partly I see Tapestry as what you might call a Bildungsalbum, that is to say, an album which is about growing up and becoming an adult. And in fact, Carole King's whole career, starting out writing like singles and AM radio songs for basically for teens or for girls, quote unquote, and then coming out with this album, which is obviously for women during the era of women's liberation, actually sort of indexes and represents the very development from a culture which actually called women girls, right? So in the early 60s, girls was a very common term to use, you know, in the office, in common parlance. And part of the achievement of women's liberation, and I see Aretha's, you know, the song for Aretha as representing this, is the insistence actually on being acknowledged as, you know, adult female, as a woman. And so I see part of the power of Carole King's album, of Tapestry, is that it represents that, not only a declaration of independence, right, she was newly divorced, but also a statement of adult maturity. And what made Carole King so able to do that is she had written the songs for girls, right? She had written the songs that were more about first love and you know, being a virgin, and then writing songs about, you know, full adult sexual experience with the term woman. I think that really represented that for really a whole generation.
And you write about how your personal story aligns with King's family story. You write, "My mother left my father and joined the women's liberation movement in 1970. I was 6 and my sister was 4. Like Carole King and her children, we had just moved to California from New York City. And from that point on, my sister and I were counterculturally co-parented." Can you talk a little bit about the environment that you grew up in and how it relates?
Absolutely. And, you know, so I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1970s. Divorce was the norm. I don't remember any married parents of my friends. And, of course, my mother listened to Tapestry. So the sort of hook that I have for writing about Carole King is I feel like I experienced the revolution in parenting and the revolution in domestic relationships that was partly represented by that album. And it had Carole King was in fact not a single parent, but she sort of her public image was as a single parent. It always was about her and her daughters. And so and the idea of having less conventional relationships, in other words, really breaking away from the two-car garage nuclear family kind of model of the 50s, and basically experimenting in what might work better, because we, you know, my parents, that generation didn't have clear models of what the better way was to raise their kids. So it was like being in a massive domestic social experiment in terms of sexual and social and personal relationships. So I feel a great affinity with the album, you know, not quite as if my mother wrote it, but as if it represented a sort of soundtrack to the new family setups that we were trying to forge. And music was really important to that, right? So in the 60s, kids listened to different music than their parents. You know, their music always irritated their parents or offended them. But I grew up listening to the Beatles with my parents and listening to Tapestry and Carole King and Don McLean and Marvin Gaye. You know, we shared the rock revolution, the album era experience, and I think it was part of what it wasn't just a soundtrack, it was part of the, you know, almost the ideology or the cultural messaging that helped us try to figure out what were some better ways to raise kids and to have romantic relationships.
And so let's listen to a little bit of one Carole King song that hits the sentiment home. It's a little bit of the classic breakup song, "It's Too Late."
And it's too late, baby, now it's too late. Though we really did try to make it something.
Now, one thing that might help people to get through rough breakups are good friends. The song "You've Got a Friend" opens sides two of the vinyl album, and you write that it's a true musical masterpiece. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Just for
"You've Got a Friend," for people of that era. One huge song after another from this album. Let's get one caller in here anyway. Sarah in Jersey City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Yes, hi. I'm a big fan of Carole King, and in fact, I went to see the Broadway show twice on Broadway called Beautiful. And I wondered how accurate was the Broadway show to her actual life? Was any of it fictionalized, or did they gloss over something?
And Sarah, I'm going to leave it there because the connection is so bad. But if you couldn't hear her, Professor Glashy was asking, was the Broadway show beautiful, true to life, genuine, or how much was it fictionalized about Carole King?
It was basically true to life, and in fact, it was based on Carole King's autobiography, A Natural Woman. There were some of the darker elements of the sort of slow motion breakup with Jerry Goffin that happened over the course of the 60s. Not all of that was included, and I think that was probably appropriate as a sort of respect of King's privacy. But all the biographical elements that were in it are confirmed in her autobiography. And in one interesting story about that that musical, originally they intended to make it just about the 60s, but folks immediately realized that they had to bring Tapestry, and they had to have it end with Tapestry in order to remind everyone, and also I think to appeal to a broader audience. But that was accurate, and it was, I mean King was present at a number of the rehearsals, and was I don't think she collaborated on the actual composition, but she was consulted and as far as I know approved of that representation. Entirely accurate, but not total. There were a number of things that it didn't cover.
For this series, we've been talking about a variety of the most iconic albums of 1971, some more commercially successful than others. Joni Mitchell's Blue, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, Shaft by Isaac Hayes, the soundtrack, less well-known at the time, Journey in Satya Dhananda by Alice Coltrane, but it's held up and become a classic. This one, Tapestry by Carole King, was the most popular of all of these at the time. In fact, you write about the triumph of Tapestry at the Grammys. So talk about that a little bit as we start to run out of time.
Well, absolutely. It was, it was a record-breaking triumph. It swept all of the major categories, which I'm not sure has been done before or since. You asked why it wasn't maybe quite as popular, why it was a little less controversial than some of those other classic 1971 albums. And, if we can quote John Landau's gushing review, right, he starts, "It's an album of surpassing personal intimacy and musical accomplishment, and a work infused with a sense of artistic purpose." And then he adds, "It is also easy to listen to and easy to enjoy." And without dissing the album at all, I think we can say that the album did look forward to that category, easy listening. The album is a comfort, right? It makes you feel better. It makes you feel like you've got a friend. It makes you feel like you've got someone who's like you out there. And so while it is definitely a political album, I think it aligns exactly with women's liberation, it's not an album maybe that challenges you in the same way that What's Going On or Blue might, created more of a, controversy than Tapestry. There was no controversy over Tapestry. Everybody loved it.
Lauren Glass from the University of Iowa is the author of Carole King's Tapestry. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
On WNYC with our Thanksgiving special today. Highlights from our series this year, Iconic at 50, about music from 1971 that has stood the test of time. Now, Master of Reality by the band Black Sabbath. Our special guest for this is Henry Rollins. You may know him as the former frontman of the hardcore punk group Black Flag. Henry hosts a weekly radio show on NPR member station KCRW in Southern California. Maybe you know him from that. He's also a self-described Black Sabbath advocate. Thanks for doing this, Henry. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thanks, Brian.
Before we get into some songs from the album and play some more music clips, for our listeners who actually may not be familiar with Black Sabbath, that's vocalist Ozzy Osbourne, guitarist Tony Iommi, bassist Geezer Butler, and drummer Bill Ward. For the uninitiated, even if they've heard of Ozzy Osbourne, can you talk a bit about who they were before Master of Reality came out?
Well, Master of Reality was their third album. It came out in July of 1971. It was preceded by the Paranoid album, which came out in September of 1970, which gave them a huge hit, the song Paranoid, which made them huge all over the world, especially in America. And before that, in 1969, they put out the album Black Sabbath, which had the song Black Sabbath. These three albums really established them and kind of established a new genre, what eventually became known as heavy metal. So I think by the time Master of Reality came out, and you have to remember that between the first and third albums is a little under a year and a half. So the band is probably being poked by the record company, like, keep making music because it's selling. Mm-hmm. And that often is the ruin of a band. But Black Sabbath was so good, they made three really strong albums. And I think the most together of those three albums would be the third one, Master of Reality, as far as sounds, playing, chops, the way the rhythm section swings, how the quality of the vocals and Ozzy's singing, the songwriting, the compositions, the song Into the Void that you just played, I think is one of Black Sabbath's master strokes. And it's my personal favorite Black Sabbath album and has been for about 40 years or so.
Let's talk about the genre that you just called heavy metal. In a recent interview for Loudwire, the bassist from Black Sabbath, Geezer Butler, put it this way in terms of a social context for the emergence of that. He said, we'd grown up in the aftermath of World War II and Aston, where we were from, still had bombed out buildings and neighbors with war wounds. At the time of Master of Reality, Vietnam was raging, the Cold War was at its coldest, the troubles in Northern Ireland were close to home, a few others were singing about the underside of life, but we had the heaviness to hammer the subjects home, unquote. So you want to talk a bit about how the heaviness of the instruments and the lyrics, like we heard in the intro to the song, Into the Void, help convey the experience of the band's generation at that time?
Sure. You have to remember, parts of England at that time, young people were growing up not seeing trees, going years and years of their life never eating real eggs, you know, still on powdered eggs. And as Geezer said, parts of your town are bombed out. Like, you're after school, you're playing in the ruins of what World War II wrought upon your town. The band is from the Birmingham area, which is central England, very, very industrial. And I've read an interview with Tony Iommi at one point where he said, we were just emulating the sounds of our city, which is a lot of the clanging and banging of, like, the guts of a factory. And I think that the Black Sabbath guys were just not inhibited by the cool people in London. They're kind of remote in the center of England, left to their own devices. And I think they just wrote lyrics about what they were seeing around them and what they were feeling. And they weren't trying to necessarily make it on the radio. And I think that ended up being one of their strengths. They weren't trying to please necessarily. And they were just doing what they thought was the right thing to do without concern for radio success. And I've talked a lot with all four members of Black Sabbath. And they make jokes about how they're failures. I'm like, how can you say you're a failure with like 75 million records sold? Probably more by now. And they just laugh and go like, oh, no one likes us. I'm like, oh, come on. Everyone likes you guys. And so I think they were just kind of telling you what was on their minds. In those days, it's kind of a standout thing to do. In fact, I would go as far as to say it's pretty punk rock.
In this series, Henry, we've talked a lot about how the Vietnam War figures into the iconic albums of that year, but we haven't really gotten into what we could consider the even broader context, which was the Cold War. And that bird's eye view is something that really comes up in this record again and again in the lyrics. Here's a bit of the song, Children of the Grave. All right, and Smith. Those lyrics were a little hard to hear. Children of tomorrow live in the tears that fall today. Will the sun rise up tomorrow, bringing peace in any way? Must the world live in the shadow of atomic fear? Can they win the fight for peace, or will they disappear? Now, the UK was not essentially a part of the Vietnam War as we think of the U.S., but you want to talk about how the themes of mutually assured destruction, as they refer to there in that line about atomic fear, come up in this album?
Sure. If you think about the Vietnam War, as horrible as it was very localized to Vietnam, parts of Cambodia and Laos. And so if you're in England, you're not getting any on you, if you will. But nuclear destruction, you know, if there's wind, you're gonna suffer. And so that brings in all of humankind. And I think that's a bit what they were getting at with Children of the Grave. There's a line in there towards the end of the song, "All you children of today are children of the grave." And I think that's Geezer Butler wrote the lyric. He was the primary songwriter, lyric writer for Black Sabbath, and a really great lyricist too. And I think he was trying to say, we're all in this together because of the nature of what a nuclear bomb can do. And the Cold War, as far as your danger level, it could be everybody's war. And you remember from 1962, October, the Cuban Missile Crisis, we find out later, decades later, McNamara, Secretary of Defense McNamara, met with his Russian counterpart as two old wise men. And we find out that the Russians were much closer to pressing the button. Like we were, it was much worse than our worst nightmares. It was apparently very, very close to go, which we might not be having this conversation right now. Mm. And I think, I remember being a young person listening to Master of Reality, and it was the idea of nuclear destruction and environmental damage that struck me as being really amazing about Black Sabbath, like what they're getting at lyrically. Because, you know, they got every bad review known, like, they, you know, they're dumb, they're thugs, they can't play.
Right. Bang,
but if you
bang,
listen
bang
carefully to the records, the rhythm section swings, the guitar player is amazing, and Ozzy's an iconic singer. And the lyrics are anything but stupid.
We have some interesting-looking calls coming in. Let's take a couple. Catherine in Manhattan, who remembers being 14 in 1971. Hi, Catherine. What's your Black Sabbath story?
Hi there. Well, I grew up in Holland, Michigan, and which is a very conservative area. But for some reason, at that time, the 1970s, there were many people who were very knowledgeable about music and art, et cetera. So my best friend and I were taken to a concert in Grand Rapids, Michigan by my friend's older brother. And there was such an outpouring of young people. I mean, everybody was so excited to attend this concert because in my area, there wasn't a lot of, there weren't a lot of bands that came through. Frank Zappa came, that was fabulous. But then Black Sabbath was another experience. So in the vestibule, as we were getting into the space, it was just packed with young people. And it was so packed, it was one of those experiences where people were getting lifted off the ground and everyone was trying to, you know, push in. And there was condensation on the windows and people were writing, "I can't breathe." And it was very impactful, this whole experience. But finally, everybody got in. And the band was so unbelievable. It just, you know, it was a small space and there's so much sound. I think that it was a coming of age for many of us who lived in that area.
Catherine, thank you so much for that story. We're going to go right to Taylor in Elmhurst. You're on WNYC. Hi, Taylor.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thank you for having me. I grew up in El Salvador in the 1970s. And Black Sabbath, my brother introduced me to Black Sabbath. And that was in the middle of the war that we were having. That was our sanctuary. That was the music that we were the outcasts. When we were young and poor, you were either in the military or you were either in the guerrillas. there was nothing in between, but there was in between. It was us, the outcasts, the poor people that had nothing left to live for. And so Black Sabbath and all those lyrics, and Children of the Grave was so like personal. It's so normal at the time to see dead bodies on the sidewalk, and you would wonder, is it really that true? So that music was just, personally to me, it was a sanctuary. It was this fascinating.
This is an amazing story, and don't go away yet, Taylor. Henry Rollins, is this a surprise to you that people were listening to Black Sabbath in El Salvador in 1971?
That doesn't surprise me at all. I think Black Sabbath is one of those rare bands that anywhere there's electricity, there's going to be fans because they speak to real people. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
What about? Go ahead, Taylor. Yeah, you go.
If I may add the following, we were that poor. If visualize one of those parties of let's say the Bee Gees, you know, one of those pop musics. And you will have the preppy boys going in, dancing with the girls. And we were the outcasts. We couldn't even have money to go in and buy a soda pop. So we were the ones outside, just wondering, can we ever go in? But that music sucked. And then when it came to Black Sabbath, that was us. And so even Grandma used to tell me that we were listening to devil worshiping. And it had nothing to do with it. It had to do with us. It was something that connected us. That we understood, and mind this, at the time, I think if you were listening to, you know, bands like Sabbath and Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin, you were thought to be, a pothead, you know, uh-huh. Which didn't make sense. We were just enjoying it, you know.
And Taylor, so, thank you so much for your call. Thank you. You know, I'm going to play another track excerpt. Coming out of one thing that he mentioned, because Black Sabbath has been associated with Satanism since the beginning. That's because the year before Master of Reality came out, Black Sabbath's first self-titled LP, meaning just called Black Sabbath, featured an upside-down cross in the gatefold sleeve. But there's one song on the album that might seem a bit out of character if Satanism was what listeners were expecting. Let's take a listen to a little bit of After Forever. And could it be you're afraid of what your friends might say if they knew you believe in God above? They should realize before they criticize that God is the only way to love. So that's on Master of Reality. Surprising for Sabbath fans, or where does the whole supposed Satanism thing come in?
Well, if you ever hung out with the Black Sabbath guys, I don't think you'd be thinking that there's any Satan going on. I think that was just something they wrote a song about. I don't think there's any rituals or any of that. Geezer Butler wrote that lyric, and I think Geezer was raised religiously, so I think that kind of pertains to perhaps his upbringing. But I never bought into Black Sabbath being anything more than a rock band, and also those guys were really young when they wrote those songs. I think you can, as a young person, you can say all kinds of things and not necessarily be able to intellectually back them up or have to be all that responsible. It's not like anyone's going to lose everything because of someone mentioned Satan in a song.
We've just got a few minutes left. Question about you and your relationship to this, because if I understand my music history, exactly 40 years ago this month, you quit your day job as head manager of a Häagen-Dazs ice cream shop in D.C. to join the band Black Flag, which is widely considered to be one of the first hardcore punk bands. What kind of line can we draw from Black Sabbath's Master of Reality 50 years ago to punk rock and the genres that came later in the 70s and, you know, 40 years ago when you joined Black Flag? What's the legacy of the album and that lineage 50 years on?
Well, your last caller said, you know, he's too broke to get into the dance hall. So he's outside with his friends. And Black Sabbath was their band. the outsider's band. You're not the quarterback. You're not going to meet the cheerleader. Black Sabbath is your band. You know, look at the four members of the band, four rough-looking guys from a tough part of England. They're not. They don't look like rock stars. They look like, you know, guys who punch your lights out outside of a bar. And there's outsider people anywhere you look, and that just describes many punk rockers. Also, people who are politically aware or ecologically aware or aware of corruption in government. And Black Sabbath goes after all of that. And Black Sabbath is afraid to say not everything's going okay. Like, their love songs are like, they're about loss. And I think a lot of people would prefer the clearer lens of real life rather than the kind of sugar water of pop music, which I don't mind all the time. Yeah. But a good dose of Sabbath is a good thing. And I think there's a lot of parallels between the music of Black Sabbath and a lot of punk rock bands, the outsider nature, the aim at truth, and not being accepted necessarily by the mainstream and not really being concerned.
We're going to go out on one last song from the album called Lord of This World, and it really ties together the heavy sound and disaffected lyrics that we've been talking about. So we want to thank Henry Rollins, self-described Black Sabbath advocate, formerly the lead vocalist of the band Black Flag, and now host of a weekly radio show on NPR member station KCRW. Henry, thanks so much for coming on. This was really fun.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
You're searching for your mind, don't know where to start. Can't find the key to fit the lock on your heart.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and that is the theme song from the 1971 movie Shaft by Isaac Hayes. We're looking at, or rather listening to, some iconic albums that turn 50 this year and digging into the political and social context in which they were made and their impact on both music and culture. And joining me now to talk about Shaft, the soundtrack, is John Burlingame, music journalist who writes regularly for Variety, music and TV theme expert, and host of Four Scores podcast. That's not Four Scores as in the Gettysburg Address. That's For Scores, you know, musical scores. He recently wrote a piece on the soundtrack Shaft for Variety titled How Isaac Hayes Shaft Reinvented the Game for Film Music. John, thanks for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's start here. Like, and listeners, we're going to play some more tracks, excerpts as we go. But like the other albums we've covered in the series, the Shaft soundtrack was really a catalyst for change for Isaac Hayes. Can you talk a little bit about who he was before 1971?
It's really remarkable when you think that he was only 29 when he won the Academy Award for Best Song for this score. Here was a kid who was raised largely by his grandparents, who picked cotton in the fields outside of Memphis, Tennessee, where he grew up, who taught himself to play organ and piano and flute and saxophone as a kid, and who by his early 20s was not just writing songs, but a talented songwriter who got hits for Stax in the late 1960s.
And for the completely uninitiated, is it relevant to talking about Isaac Hayes and the cultural context of that song and that album? It's a double album. There's a lot of music on it. Can you briefly summarize the movie Shaft and its place in the culture at that time?
Yeah, perhaps a good point to do that, because Shaft was not thought of as a particularly important film at the time. It was an action-adventure movie set in Harlem, starring Richard Roundtree as a black private eye who winds up sort of stuck between white and black gangs at the time. And MGM made it, and they were not doing so well, and therefore I think perhaps open to what might be thought of as a more commercially risky project, which is a largely black-acted film set in Harlem, and like only a handful of films before it, really kind of aimed at the African-American movie-going audience.
And you write, with key members of his Memphis band, augmented by a small ensemble of Hollywood veterans, Hayes came up with a signature sound for that memorable opening scene, hi-hat cymbals and wah-wah guitar. How do you think the theme song for Shaft that we heard at the beginning of the segment, we heard exactly that part, tells the story of the character?
What I find so wonderful, I think, about Hayes' accomplishment here is that he had never even been near a movie studio. He'd never written any kind of film music before. And yet, perhaps because of what we had heard in 1969 in his Hot Buttered Soul album, you could tell that he had a dramatic instinct. He had not just the ability to write music in the soul and R&B genre of music making, but he seemed to almost immediately understand what was necessary to write a dramatic score, which is what you really need to do when you're working in film. And so he applied what he knew best, which was his sort of Stax style, of not just a soul tune, but sort of augmented with strings and flutes, which I also talk about in the article, and apply that to what was necessary for an action-adventure movie. I still think it's extraordinary.
Listeners, wondering if anyone out there right now remembers buying Isaac Hayes' Shaft album. Were you one of the first people to get your hands on it 50 years ago when it came out because you were already an Isaac Hayes fan or because you saw the movie and liked the music? And if you're younger, how were you introduced to the album if you're a fan of the album now? For those of you who heard our 1971 album segment about the Alice Coltrane album, well, maybe this is one a little bit like that, where it was out there, but it's more legendary today than it was then, even though very different, because the Alice Coltrane Journey in Satchitananda album was obscure at the time. Shaft was in the pop culture. But I think, John, that the reputation of an album that grows to sort of classic status can start from either side. It can be, oh, yeah, that pop culture thing, Shaft, or it can be this obscure, you know, artsy thing like the Alice Coltrane album, and yet here they are, both being legendary 50 years later.
Oh boy, I love that. I love that comparison. And it just reminds us, I suppose, in a very difficult time in America now, how important music is in our lives. The music that we grew up with, the music that we discovered, particularly in our younger years, and the music we're hearing now. I thank God that I'm in a position to be able to write about this and to enjoy music and write about it at the same time.
Let's hear a little more. Most of the soundtrack is instrumental, being a movie score. But besides Shaft, the theme song, there's a song called Soulsville, which features lyrics.
Slums, ghetto, and black belt, they are one and the same, and I call it.
And I call it Soulsville. Want to reflect a bit on those lyrics and the fact that they're really the main lyrics of the album?
Well, what's interesting to me about it is that that's what we would normally in film music refer to as source music. That is generally heard in the background, often in a bar or a dance hall or a disco or someplace where we don't necessarily notice the lyrics. But it was an opportunity here for Isaac Hayes to write something other than the instrumentals that were sort of propelling the film along. And it's a great example of the fact that here was an opportunity for him to talk about the black experience in America that he was seeing, that he was feeling, and that he knew his brothers and sisters were feeling at the time. So it's a highlight of the album, I think, and certainly one of the most important tunes he wrote for Shaft.
And you're right, the Shaft single went to number one in November 1971, as did the album, and that the film was among the 20 top-grossing movies of 1971 and launched the so-called blaxploitation genre. Can you talk a bit about that genre? What was it all about? And for people who don't know, what does that word even mean?
Yeah, well, blaxploitation is a term that was invented around that time. It basically refers to films that were being made mostly in Hollywood, although there were some independent films, that were designed specifically to appeal to African-American audiences. And they had largely black casts and were occasionally, as in the case of Shaft, made by African-American writers and directors. In this case, the director was Gordon Parks, who had had quite a celebrated career as a photojournalist for life, and who had made a film in 1969 called The Learning Tree, based on his own life. So it was again, kind of risky of MGM to devote these kinds of resources and to choose these talented African-American artists to make a movie specifically for that audience. And, of course, as we know, it crossed over into a massive white audience as well.
Here's an aspect of it musically that I love. Hayes' son, Isaac Hayes III, views the Shaft soundtrack as validation of his father's ideas about soul music. The younger Hayes told you he always wanted to incorporate flutes and strings, his dad, like Motown, and mixing the two was frowned upon by a lot of people on the Memphis music scene. So let's listen to just a little example of a bit of soul mixed with flutes and strings on the song Reggio's Cafe. So do you want to elaborate a little bit more on what Hayes' son told you? Like, was there a camp that says, wow, that really swings, and wow, what use of orchestral instruments, strings and flutes, and another camp that says, oh, don't muck it up with all that stuff?
You know, it's true and so funny to look back on it from 50 years later, and we sort of take that for granted now. But, you know, I think the thing is, when you have a commercial success, as some record labels did in that era, and you establish a house style that dictates certain things that are done and not done, it sometimes can be thought of as risky to depart from that format. But I think Hayes' success with the Hot Buttered Soul album in 69 clearly indicated that he had an aesthetic, and he made musical choices that were perhaps, from the Memphis point of view, outside the box. But boy, it worked. And that particularly, the Cafe Reggio's tune, is one of my favorites on the album. The album as a whole is partly soul, partly R&B. There's a little funk. There's some jazz and some blues. It is just such a magnificent piece of work.
Debbie in the Bronx, you're on WNYC as we talk about Isaac Hayes' Shaft film score at 50 years old. Hi, Debbie.
Hi, Brian. Listen to you all the time. Love this show. I'm a black woman. I went to see the movie because it was it's something so new at that time. I saw the movie 3 times, not for the acting, but for the music. And I grew up on jazz. Daddy was a real jazz buff. I played that album to death. The theme song, Chef, I can't number how many times I've heard it. It still excites me every time I listen to it. I hear something that I didn't hear before. It is just a phenomenal piece of music. And the whole album was great, but that theme song, it still blows my mind.
Debbie, thank you so much. Judith in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Judith.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to say, mentioning Cafe Reggio, I still stop in there sometime and always think about it. It's one of my favorite songs also. I just wanted to say that I was at Isaac Hayes' last concert, which was right here in Brooklyn in Prospect Park, June 2008, and he passed away 2 months after that. And if Isaac Hayes, he was a wonderful composer, not just Chef, but Hot Buttered Soul. He was such a fabulous composer that I always think that, unfortunately, if he had been a white male working in the music business, he would have had so much more acclaim, the acclaim that he deserved.
Judith, thank you very much. John, thinking about Debbie from the Bronx's call and how she went back to the movie, to see the movie again and again, largely for the music, it makes me think of the passage that you wrote, that the success of his 2-LP soundtrack album assured that every black action-adventure film for the next several years would be scored by a major artist of color. So what was the legacy of the soundtrack in film in that respect?
Yeah, I think it took Hollywood by storm, in a sense, because once again, Hollywood studios did tend to be risk-averse. And I think that the unusual choice of having a black artist do a soundtrack, again, it's something he'd never done before and which really worked, opened the door and opened, I should say, the eyes, really, of studio executives to the idea that, okay, now that we know this works, let's do it every time out from now on. So you wind up with Curtis Mayfield doing Superfly in 74, and you wind up with Bobby Womack doing Across 110th Street, and you wind up with Marvin Gaye doing Trouble Man in 72. And in many cases, these albums were actually more successful than the movies themselves, or at least are very, in many cases, better remembered.
We're going to play a couple of clips here. Music clips, and spoiler alert, one of them is not from Shaft. Hayes's son told you that the soundtrack is something that producers of hip-hop consistently go to for inspiration or just to find that really good sample. So let's take a little listen first to some of Bumpy's Lament from the Shaft soundtrack, and listen closely to the end of this clip, folks, where the sample is played. All right, remember that ending. Here's one example of the Shaft soundtrack being used for samples. Here's Dr. Dre's classic 2001 song, Explosive. So, from that little snippet, what was the impact of the album on rap music that would come much later on, or even R&B?
I think that what it shows us is that groups like Public Enemy and Dr. Dre and Tupac and Big Daddy Kane all revered what Isaac Hayes had done and understood what that legacy was and took inspiration from it, not to mention the samples, for their own work. I think in many ways it's an homage to Hayes to utilize that material. And, you know, they all seem to recognize that this is quality stuff and worth employing in their own music.
You write that Hayes skipped scoring the Shaft sequels, Shaft's Big Score in 1972 and Shaft in Africa in 1973, because you quote him saying, "I don't like repeating myself and I don't think I do them justice." But much later on in his career, he did something completely unexpected. From 1997 until 2006, he voiced the character Chef on the oftentimes controversial animated adult sitcom South Park. Listeners, did you know that Isaac Hayes did the voice of Chef on South Park? So let's listen to just a bit of season 1, episode 1, where Chef is introduced.
Chef, have you ever had something happen to you, but nobody believed you?
Oh, children, children. That's a problem we've all had to face at some time or another. Here, let me sing you a little song. It might clear things up. I'm gonna make love to you, woman. Gonna lay you down by the fire.
So, in a way, Isaac Hayes is poking fun at himself and the legacy he had created. I also think Chef was probably the most sympathetic character in South Park. But want to weigh in on that, or maybe what his time at South Park might say about the kind of artist that he was?
Well, I think that those guys who did the South Park cartoons clearly appreciated Isaac Hayes. And what does that say about Isaac Hayes himself, willing to poke fun at his own reputation and in doing so found an entirely new generation who perhaps knew nothing of his earlier career or music and sort of helps to usher him into a brand new 21st century audience in a way.
And we're appropriately, I think, going to go out on the last song on the album called The End Theme. But before we do, you quote David Arnold, the composer who scored the 2000 sequel of Shaft, on the original score. He told you that idiosyncratic approach, singular voice, and understanding of the character and the world he occupied, Isaac Hayes was intimate with that world culturally, ethnically, societally. He was part of the black experience in America at that time. So, of course, he was going to translate that into amazing music. Rumor has it that Isaac Hayes tried out for the part of Shaft, the acting part, in our last 30 seconds or so. Is that true?
We are told it's true. We don't know if he actually got the opportunity to audition, but he certainly wanted the part. And, of course, he went on to play roles in many different films after that, notably Escape from New York, which is one of my favorites. But it is said that he tried desperately to actually take on the role of Shaft.
And there we leave it with our guest, John Burlingame, music journalist who writes regularly for Variety, music and TV theme expert, and host of For Scores, the podcast. He recently wrote a piece on the soundtrack for Variety titled How Isaac Hayes Shaft Reinvented the Game for Film Music. This was great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Brian.
The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. And that is George Harrison, in case you don't know, singing Bangladesh at a 1971 concert, later released as a live album, called The Concert for Bangladesh. It was a star-studded concert at Madison Square Garden on August 1st, 1971, that many consider to be the very first big rock benefit concert in history. On the show, we've been looking at, or rather listening to, some iconic albums that turned 50 this year and digging into the political and social context in which they were made and their impact on both music and culture. The music historians say 1971 was a particularly important year. And joining me now to conclude this series and talk about the concert for Bangladesh is Aaron Cohen, professor at the City Colleges of Chicago and author of several books on music, including Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music, and Black Cultural Power. He wrote about the benefit concert earlier in the summer for NPR. The article is titled Ravi Told George, They Told the World, The Birth of the Celebrity Benefit Concert. Aaron, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And for people who've never heard of the concert for Bangladesh, it might seem a little random that a former member of the Beatles was singing about a humanitarian crisis that many people at that time hadn't even heard about in this country or in the West in general. So let's take a listen to a little of the intro to the song Bangladesh, where Harrison explains how he got interested in the issue.
My friend came to me. Sadness in his eye, told me that he wanted help for his country.
And that friend who came to him that Harrison was singing about was Indian musician and sitar player Ravi Shankar. Can you talk briefly about their friendship and how they came to know each other?
Oh, yes. Well, in the 1960s, when George Harrison was the lead guitarist in the Beatles, he started playing the Indian sitar, and Ravi Shankar was his sitar teacher, guru. It's a very difficult instrument to learn, and it's a very difficult instrument to play, so George Harrison had the best teacher in Ravi Shankar. But Ravi Shankar was also a mentor in a lot of spiritual ways that included playing the instrument, but went beyond it. And they continued their friendship throughout their lives, and Ravi Shankar in 1971, Ravi Shankar was also from a Bengali family, and Ravi Shankar was very sad about what was going on when the Pakistani government and the military dictatorship of Pakistan very brutally suppressed an independence movement that was in East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, and causing a huge, not just number of deaths, but a huge refugee crisis into India. And he mentioned it to George Harrison, and George Harrison very quickly assembled this benefit concert in Madison Square Garden, and he used his contacts, his friendship, his star power, his charisma to enlist a bunch of other of the big rock stars of the day to perform this concert benefit.
Listeners, were any of you there? We can take a few phone calls from anybody who actually attended the concert for Bangladesh at Madison Square Garden on August 1st, 1971. What do you remember from it? And did it change you politically and socially at all, in addition to enjoying the tunes? And before we get off the Ravi Shankar aspect of this, he actually opened up the concert for Bangladesh. And you write, even though Harrison, along with his British and American rock star friends, drove ticket sales for the concert for Bangladesh, Shankar's opening performance meant music from the impacted region was represented. So let's take a listen to a bit of Ravi Shankar playing a traditional Bengali folk song on sitar from the concert for Bangladesh. Ravi Shankar in 1971. Sam on Cape Cod right now. Hi, Sam. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. I remember it like it was yesterday. When my friends and I, there were four of us all together, heard about this, when tickets went on sale, we made a beeline to Madison Square Garden, which is where you had to go to get the tickets. We slept overnight on the sidewalk outside, leaning on the wall of the garden, and got our tickets, and the show was unbelievable. We were all political activists at the time to begin with, so the fact that he was doing this as a benefit concert was sort of an added bonus for us. But to be honest, it was about the music, and it was about a Beatle performing again. Mm-hmm. And we were at the afternoon show, and nobody knew that Bob Dylan was an unannounced guest. Nobody knew that he was going to be there. And I believe he hadn't played live for years because this was post his motorcycle accident. And when he came out on the stage, people were literally weeping. It was hard to describe. There was such excitement in the air and emotion. And when then he did this amazing set with Leon Russell and George Harrison. It was probably the best concert I've ever been to. Ah,
Sam, thank you so much for that memory. And talk about worlds colliding. British rock context of George Harrison from the Beatles and the American folk rock context of Bob Dylan. And you write, and my guest is music journalist Aaron Cohn, pop artists became looked upon as more than just entertainers during the late 1960s, early 1970s, and this was the first large-scale pop music event to benefit a major human rights issue. And so a lot of stars wanted to be part of it. Dylan, and he mentioned Leon Russell, and Eric Clapton was also there, to name a few. So is Billy Preston, who became known as the Fifth Beatle. So let's listen to a bit of The Way God Planned It, Billy Preston from that night in 1971.
All things God given, and they all have been blessed. That's the way God planned it. That's the way God wants it to be.
All right, we're going to end the show here and just listen to Billy Preston for the rest of our time. No, I'm kidding. But Aaron, it's tempting, right? What was the spirit of the concert like with all these big egos on one stage? Was there any drama?
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing. Like I mentioned, it's very quickly put together. So to have a very large, there's also, you know, horn players and backup singers, along with all of those musicians who you named. So for such a quickly put together, large scale event, it went really well, all things considered. And, that whole spirit, actually, I want to actually mention a thing about Billy Preston was, he became known as the Fifth Beatle because he performed toward the end of their time in 1969 on what became known as their rooftop concert. But one of the interesting things about Billy Preston was he came from a background of African-American gospel music and African-American R&B, working with Little Richard and Ray Charles. And I think that gospel spirit pervaded not just through Billy Preston's set, but a lot of George Harrison's music. A lot of George Harrison's music was connected to Indian spirituality and Indian mysticism as well, but he was also drawing from American gospel music on such songs as My Sweet Lord, which he performed at the concert, and Waiting on You All, which we also performed. So Billy Preston's presence and the music he represented was very important to this communal feeling of the event.
Leslie and Passaic, you were there. Hi, Leslie.
Yes, hi. This is so much fun. I did not remember that it was my birthday, my 13th birthday, when I was at that concert.
August 1st,
August
huh?
1st.
Huh.
Yes, and now I just had my 63rd birthday, so it's a little wild to hear you talk about this.
So what do you remember from it?
I remember, well, first of all, me and all my girlfriends who went from junior high school, Ditmas Junior High School in Brooklyn, were so in love with George Harrison. He was our favorite Beatle. And what I remember also is that we had never heard anything like Ravi Shankar. We had never, as girls growing up in Brooklyn, we'd never heard any international music at all. And to see this man come on with these strange instruments, these sitars and everything, was a really interesting element that I think opened me up for the rest of my life to hearing different sounds and combinations of music. And then with Billy Preston rocking it on the drums, he was amazing. And Leon Russell was I didn't even remember until you started talking about it that Leon Russell was there and how great he was as well.
Leslie, thank you so much for that memory. Joni in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. You were there too?
Brian, my girlfriend called me like an hour or two before the show and said she had an extra ticket. Can I be ready? Can I be ready? Zoom, I was ready. And it was so exciting. So thank you, Jane Mack. This was in high school, 1970. I was 15 years old. Now I'm 66. But I saw everybody there. I mean, Preston and Russell and Shankar, Dylan, Clapton. I mean, you name it. So my husband teases me to this day. Did you see this artist? Yes, at Bangladesh. Did you see that artist? Yes, at Bangladesh, because there were so many stars there. It was great energy and one of the best concerts that I've been to.
John, and you've been to many, it sounds like, yes. Thank you for the memory. So Aaron, and with music journalist Aaron Cohen, remembering the 1971 concert for Bangladesh as part of a 1971 in music history series. And you write that while Harrison and Shankar said their motives were not political, they did cause consternation among Pakistan's military regime and its enablers in the United States. So really, George Harrison, a.k.a. the quietest Beatle, was angering military regimes?
Absolutely. And this is from Gary J. Bass's book, The Blood Telegram, Nixon, Kissinger, and a Forgotten Genocide. And essentially, Pakistan was doing all of these horrible atrocities, and they were being aided and abetted by the Nixon and Kissinger, I was going to call them something else, but let's leave it at that. Anyway, Nixon, Kissinger, and the Pakistani regime did not want the world's attention. The last thing they wanted was for the world to bring, you know, the situation in what's now Bangladesh to the public eye. And they responded. The Pakistani government felt that the Bangladesh record was, and this is their words from the Bass book, that it was anti-Pakistan propaganda, and they also made a reference to the Beatles trio doing it, which again was wrong. But anyway, they said it was hostile propaganda against Pakistan. And Bass also reports about, you know, Nixon being angry and yelling at Kissinger about how, you know, angry he was that in his words, the Beatles were raising money for India, and how, you know, terrible it was. And what they were really afraid of was that this concert was shedding light on atrocities that they wanted to keep in the dark. And that was an incredible thing for a bunch of musicians to accomplish. You know, they accomplished what activists and protesters have always wanted, which is to bring these situations to greater attention. And, you know, they got some very evil people angry at them.
Now, leading up to the concert in the spring of 1971, each of the former members of the Beatles, because they had broken up the year before, had a solo single on the charts. According to ultimateclassicrock.com, George Harrison had What Is Life, John Lennon had Power to the People, and Paul McCartney had the song Another Day. But of all the Beatles, only Ringo Starr joined Harrison's concert for Bangladesh, and he sang his 1971 hit, It Don't Come Easy. Let's take a listen.
What's a pay dues if you want to sing the blues? And you know it don't come easy. You don't have to shout or leap about. You can even play them easy.
A little off key there, maybe, but...
Ringo.
It is Ringo. If you want to sing the blues, you got to pay your dues.
Exactly. Well,
but you write, while the concert raised more than $243,000 for UNICEF, the IRS held up millions from subsequent record sales because the event's organizers had not applied for nonprofit status for this benefit concert. So to what extent was the benefit concert a monetary success or failure?
Well, they did not properly at the time cross all of the T's, dot all of the I's, but that's been resolved. And so the money, which was directed to UNICEF, they received a certain amount of money at first, and then the money from record, plus also the record companies involved were a bit skittish about doing a charity record. So there was that aspect, and George Harrison was very adamant on that getting out. But today, UNICEF is getting the money. So that tax situation got resolved a few years later, but it certainly was an obstacle to, you know, getting people who needed the money. And that was something that George Harrison would tell subsequent organizers of charity events, that, you know, all of these bureaucratic things that needed to be done. In the years since then, Harrison was a guiding force in terms of saying, okay, make sure that the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted so that there isn't this holdup.
What did the concert for Bangladesh spawn, if this was the first big rock benefit concert, in terms of a benefit concert practice or tradition? People maybe of one generation down may think of Live Aid in the 80s, a big one for famine relief in multiple African countries, I think. Do these still happen today? And did Bangladesh, the concert for Bangladesh, start something that persists?
It did. And one of the things, and this sort of came out with some of the callers, one of the advantages of Bangladesh, the concert for Bangladesh, was it introduced Indian musicians to a wide audience. It helped humanize the people who were afflicted with these tragedies. And it's a shame that some of the subsequent concerts, like Live Aid, did not include Ethiopian musicians, for instance. And I think in terms of setting up a major concert charity benefit, it did a lot of good. It set a lot of good precedents, but it also showed the ways that it should be done on a musical and cultural level that have not quite always been followed. But also, in addition to concerts, there have been foundations established by musicians. And one interesting one is the White Feather Foundation, which is being run by Julian Lennon, John Lennon's eldest son, and that is working on global indigenous rights and environmental issues. So it's not just concerts, but also actual foundations that have been set up by musicians and artists to raise awareness. And I think along with money, I think raising awareness is a crucial precedent that the Concert for Bangladesh set.
And we will have to leave it there for today. Aaron Cohen, professor at the City Colleges of Chicago and author of several books on music, including Move On Up, Chicago Soul Music and Black Cultural Power, and the author of an article for NPR called Ravi Told George, They Told the World, The Birth of the Celebrity Benefit Concert. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me. And everybody in New York, New Jersey, please stay safe.
Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. And a big thank you today to the folks behind the scenes at The Brian Lehrer Show, which is produced this fall by Lisa Allison, Zoe Azoulay, Mary Croak, Amina Cerna, Carl Boisrond, and Max Balton. Zach Goddard-Cohen works on our Daily Politics podcast. The Brian Lehrer Show interns this fall are Prerna Chowdhury and James O'Donnell. And we have Juliana Fonda at the audio controls most days. Also, Lior Noam Kravitz, Milton Ruiz, and Matt Morando. Also, Sham Sundra, depending on the day. Megan Ryan is the head of live radio. And a big shout-out to producer Amina Cerna for all her work on the iconic At 50 series, which we've been airing today. Enjoy the rest of your holiday, everybody.